All right, this is Tony and Matt, and we are chilling on the convention floor at Grand Con, and we have the pleasure to speak to Ed Greenwood. Ed, for some of our listeners who may not know who you are and what you do, because it's mainly a comic book podcast, but we talk about gaming and stuff in there too, why are you so important? Why are you the god among many?
Oh, I didn't know I had been promoted that far. I am a mild-mannered Canadian librarian who is also a fiction writer and game designer. And I created the Forgotten Realms back in 1966, before there was D&D, and have developed lots of things for it. And that means I've been involved in lots of comics to do with the Forgotten Realms, and more recently in some other comic book ventures. And what can I say? I'm just a normal geek with tons and tons of long boxes of comic books at home.
Yes, that. But, I mean, you created this world that me and my brother just, and I know some of our listeners too, just enjoy. Like, the Forgotten Realms. I've never been that immersed in a world where you have so many different writers, so many different things going on. They're all connected because they're in the same world. Like, how did you, I don't know, just decide, yeah, I'm going to do that?
When I was a little kid, I read lots of stuff in my father's den. And some of the stuff I liked the most was fantasy. And I also started reading Fantastic magazine, which he was buying as it came out. It kept jumping between every second month, and sometimes they had to add an extra issue when they were flush and so on. But they were publishing fantasy short stories. Notably, every now and then they'd have a Conan pastiche done by DeCamp and Carter. But they also had all of Fritz Leiber's Fafhrenholt and Gray Moser stories, which are, you know, episodic stories that each story stands alone, but they're also episodes in the life of these two heroes as they wander around this world. And if you only ever bought one issue of Fantastic and you didn't know that there was a connected series, you just enjoy the one story. But if you bought a bunch of issues and you say, oh, this is all set in the same world, this is cool, and you find out a little bit more about the world in each story in the background, I'm going to do that. So I came up with my own character, Mert the Moneylender, who's this fat, wheezing, the sort of guy who has floppy sea boots and he's got food stains all down his belly. He used to be a mercenary captain in his youth and made a lot of enemies, but now he's way too old. He can't move fast. He can't outrun anybody. He can't outfight anybody. He wheezes his way through life, but he tries to outsmart them, which means at the end of each story, he leaves town just ahead of his rivals or ahead of the authorities, so he has to move to the next town. So I had to create port after port on what came to be known as the Sword Coast. So I was starting up at Luskan and moving down all through Waterdeep and so on, and then I sort of created the world that way, and D&D came along 6-7 years later. So yeah, that's how it all started. I was just writing stories to entertain myself as a little kid.
And now, how did you then decide to develop, to open this world to other people? Did you just say, hey, I want to find this writer, give him a chance, and start writing in this area? Or,
well, okay, when D&D came out, the original booklets, I bought it and thought, oh, this is really cool. But nah, it's not for me, because it's just going to turn into an argument around the gaming table. But when AD&D, so the Monster Manual and the Player's Handbook, came out, I thought, oh, this is cool. This is perfect, because somebody's taken all the monsters that we know about, plus some new ones, like all the ones from mythology, and they've codified exactly what they do. And now here's somebody's taken Jack Vance's magic system from the Dying Earth stories, where when you cast a spell, you forget it. You memorize it, great effort. When you cast it, it's gone. So your magic user is not a machine gun of endless spells. He has to carefully decide, oh, if I use this now, I've lost it. Yeah, I can't use it later. So it's an asset management thing, limitations. But also, all the spells are detailed. I thought, this is really cool. So to make this work, I'm going to make the realms match this. Okay, I'm not going to tell anybody that, but because I think this is a fairly balanced way of codifying things, I'm just going to make sure everything I write for the realms matches this. Then some of my friends said, hey, you want to start a D&D campaign? I said, a what? Oh, okay. And can we just play in the realms? So I started running the realms, D&D stuff. And this would be around 1978. And then I got to thinking, well, you know, I can write stuff for Dragon, the magazine, then a print magazine. There was no dungeon at that time, and everybody who played D&D, if they could, read Dragon, players and DMs. You borrowed somebody else's copy if you couldn't afford a copy of your own. And I thought, this is a sort of semi-fair way for me to put new monsters, new spells, and new magic items and throw them at my players, because none of us had our issues sitting at the table with us or anything, but they all bought them and read them. So it was sort of like your character might have vaguely heard of this or that, this monster or this spell, and that you can simulate that in the game by the fact that they read the article 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so you felt a little fairer as a DM by throwing these things at them. You'd managed to get published in the magazine because they were sort of quasi official.
Yeah, I was going to say, they would remember it was a little bit more of a spell than what the DM would allow.
Yeah, and it was, in fact, if it was a monster and it was in Featured Creature, which became the Dragon's Bestiary, it said right on the page, this is as official as anything published in the Monster Manual. And I got paid 25 whole bucks US, which was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Its buying power is about 75 bucks now.
Okay.
You know. And so I was a young kid, and I was making all this money hand over fist, and I was sending all this stuff into Dragons, and they said, And the next time I went to Gen Con, which was in Parkside at that time, University of Wisconsin Parkside, they said, want to take a little walk? I was like, now what happens? and what they wanted to do was make me a contributing editor. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, that's the contributing part. You don't get paid anything extra. Oh, but you see, everybody wants to get their stories in the magazine and their articles in the magazine, and they'll be really pissed off if we keep using you and you over and over again. But if you're a contributing editor, it'll somehow be okay. And then the flip side of that is, we're going to occasionally ask you to write on specific topics. But in the meantime, we'll take anything you can get. So I just flooded them. It was like, whoa!
Here we go.
You know, which is where the realms came to the attention of TSR, because everybody in the industry read Dragon, which meant Jeff Grubb, who is here at the con, who you'll probably be talking to soon. He was an employee, and he was actually working on the concept of a unified world for the second edition of Dungeons & Dragons, a world that would be tailor-made to have pirates, jungles, Arctic, sort of vaguely oriental, everything in it. And the company had just spent all of its resources in 2 years creating Dragonlance. So it was great result, but huge expenditure in terms of artists, designers, fiction writers, everybody cobbling together this one thing. And although Dragonlance is a great world, it is built around a story, this big quest, you know, like Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
You are saving the world, and when you finish saving the world, then what? Everything seems like an anticlimax, but if you build a world that is for infinite stories, for anything you want to do in your D&D campaign, then it doesn't look like it's got an endpoint from a marketing and product point of view right there. It looks like hopefully it will go on forever. So rather than spend all this money, they looked around and said, hey, there's this guy. Well, call him. So Jeff literally asked me, do you make this up as you go along, or do you have a complete detailed world at home? And I said, yes. And yes. And he said, good, send it. You know, so that's where the realm started. And I was kept very busy. This is pre-internet. You know, FedEx was a brand new thing then. And each week I would pound away at the typewriter until on topics that Jeff had asked for more for, or draw stuff or map stuff and bring it all, and then send off the weekly package. And then I get this phone call saying, okay, we just had the fun of unwrapping your last package. For your next one, we need all your mini dungeons and any places where there are wizards, lots of wizards that are politically important. Write up something about send it off. And that just kept going for package after package. And that would have been 1986. 85 and 96 I was doing that. And then the realms appeared. And it's been going ever since. So,
all right.
I've always seen the similarities with the big two, Marvel and DC. They create worlds where different writers can come in.
Mm-hmm.
And the different heroes can have team-ups and they can interact. And that's always been one of my favorite things about fantasy literature, is the world building and the creating of the worlds. And, you know, for my money, the Forgotten Realms have always had the most interesting locations, political ties, and really kind of like those organizations of Dread, the Zentarum and everyone that are just, they seem to be everywhere. and they just make really good villains and really good stories. So,
and well, thank you for saying that. I think what that really comes, that's the result of my never stopping work on it. I've literally been working on it since 1966. I never stop. And most of the later work, I mean, there were some things I did to answer necessities I had. Like I was doing lots of, I work in a public library. I would do these library mini campaigns because the library was always hot to offer programs for teens.
Okay.
And because the teenagers, when you classically would lose people as patrons in a library. You had them as little kids because their parents would bring them. You had the adults, and in between you'd say, hey, you're making noise and you're bringing food and drink into the library. Get out! You know? So you'd lose your teens in the middle. And they were always wanted to have programs for teens. So you have the here's what you need to know to be a babysitter. Your safety course. Here's good grooming. Wow, that's awful. Real popular there, you know. And then what was the third one? Oh, do a game playing thing.
Hi.
And so I would play D&D. And so I had a set time to play, a certain number of sessions, 12 or 13, weekly sessions. And so therefore, to get anything done, because it was understood that I would be getting new players each time, new people. I could have a few repeats, but it was mainly to get new people and give them something to do. I would give them a task they had to do, which is where adventurers' charters came from. So that sort of thing was added to the game because, okay, if I give them an adventuring charter in a country that has rules, laws, like Cormyr, that's fairly heavily governed, then I can say, okay, you got to do this. That's a condition of your charter from the king. You got to do this. After that, you're on your own, but you got to do this. So it does. It gets away from the, well, I don't know, I've never played this game before. What are we supposed to do? It pitches them in. Yeah, so you can get off to jump. So little things like that were added throughout the years just because of necessity. They were added to the game. And I just went on adding detail, adding detail, adding detail. But as we go through the passage of time, the detail is always an answer to something a gamer needs. Like this group, if we're going to do a computer game, we need another foe for this people over here. Oh, here's one. Okay, we need to do something about this, and we need a big long adventure that leads to another one, leads to another one. Oh, okay, here's one. So I was always answering, in effect, gamer needs. Players were using their realms and say, yeah, we need to. No, in many cases, it's filtered through the company saying, you know, it would be really nice to have this so we can sell this for Christmas, but they are in turn looking at what they provided already and what people want more of, and it's give people more of what they want more of.
Well, as you said, you've never truly stopped on it. So, and I see, I haven't read your last Elminster book. I've pretty much read all of them up until then. So, about by that, with Wizards of the Coast, you know, owning Forgotten Realms now, how much control do you have over that?
Like, world still.
What happens?
Well, do you have, like, you know, you say this and that, or does Wizards of the Coast now kind of say this is what we want going on? Do you still retain control?
No,
of?
No. I haven't had artistic control of the world since 1987.
Okay.
But it is easier to continue developing the realms if whoever owns the copyright, TSR early on and Wizards of the Coast now, say to me, hey, Ed, have you got anything on? Or if they're younger staffers or newer to gaming, they may not know all the ancient history. So they can always turn to somebody else in the office. And it is the nature of any company that is protecting an IP and intellectual property to keep secrets, as in not release information to the general public about something that's coming out unless or until they want to.
Yeah.
And that's just logical. So there are some things I don't know about because I'm like any other gamer. It appears in the hobby store. I gotta have that. You know, because it's a new realms thing. Jeez, I wish I'd known.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it is advantageous because you've got this walking resource here to use the walking resource. And so by and large, yeah, they do keep me involved. What I am right at this particular point in time is a consultant. And literally, when input is needed, when you need something in a hurry, Ed gets an email. You know, can you give us like 15 different... Okay, I'm going to have this scene where this alchemist has got rows of bottles and I need something that's a painkiller, something that's an emetic, something, you know, what would be most popular? What would it be made of, and where would you buy it in Waterdeep, and what would it be called? You know, Fangled Angrel's elixir of purging, you know, and what would it look like in the bottle? Because the other thing is, if you're planning down the road, and now Wizards of the Coast is now a division of Hasbro, so if you're planning down the road is thinking, we could have lunchboxes, we could have bendable hand puppets, we could have movies, we could have a TV show, we could have a console game, we could have a massive multiplayer online, all of them. Wouldn't it be really nice if Elminster looked the same all the way through? Or if you went to Thay, they wore the same national dress or local dress. So if you're trying to establish a line look, then it's ever so much easier if people consult with each other. And so that's sort of the role now. But that's also, that's where it's coming from, the continued development of the realms, because instead of me just going, hey, here's what I was doing last week, and they go, recipes for dragons, thanks, Ed. we'll use that real soon now, stuff. I'm now giving them what they need to go on and develop the property.
So that's a large reason why recently in the realms there was all the crisis with the goddess of magic dying, and magic kind of being reinvented was partially to satisfy the needs of 4th edition Dungeons
yes.
and Dragons.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and now that Dungeons & Dragons is moving on to another version again, we see that the realms are also in a state of transition or healing. Mm-hmm. Are they, I don't know if you can let us know, but after the sundering, are they going to look a little bit more like they used to? Or are they going to still be in a kind of different state of disrepair?
Well, okay.
I don't know how much you can share.
I can tell you after the sundering that the hallmark of the realms has always been that it is a living world, and living
yes.
world implies change,
yes.
implies growth, implies a history. So we're not going to throw out the history. We're never going to do, it was all a dream, okay? It never happened, or, you know, when you step out of the shower, the world, you know, none of that.
You're not going to reboot it in the new forgotten.
No, okay. There isn't going to be a reboot that ignores the past.
Okay.
What is the 100-year jump has happened. That doesn't mean we might not go back and write stuff that is in the 100 years. One of the things we discovered immediately, I mean, the company at that time was thinking, oh, we're not going to mention what happened in the 100 years at all. And immediately we sort of broke that rule because Cormyr has this unbroken line of kings and queens. But, I mean, you know, ruling Obarskir family. And we left with this person on the throne. Now we're here with this person on the phone. What's in between?
How'd we get there? Yeah.
We have to, even if we only cover that in two lines of so and so reigned until da da da, and then so and so took over. Even if you do that, you need to draw that thread across the 100-year gap. So I can tell you that after the sundering is finished, that it will not be a reset of time. Time will have passed. Fourth edition was set in 1479, the year of the Ageless One. Time is moving on, not at a huge jump that it was, maybe 12 years, maybe 14, because the sundering itself does take time, the events of the sundering. But yeah, we will be moving on in time, a small amount of thing, and the realms will probably look a little more like what was familiar to earlier gamers gaming in the earlier versions of the realms in terms of some of the continents and some of the features, because Abirin Toril passed into conjunction. They're now sundering apart from each other and moving away again. So some of the stuff that traded places may trade back. You're probably going to see some of the gods that went away. Yeah, some gods are going to come back.
Okay.
But in terms of specifics, no. I'm just giving you the general impression.
I'm really excited because
the other thing you cannot do. You see, here's the thing. If you say to old gamers, you know, the guys who and gals who have been buying your stuff for decades, saying, you know, all that stuff. It's like when you set a new origin story in comics and you say, you know, you guys who've been buying, you know, let's call him Blunderman for 40 years. You suckers, we've got your money.
Yeah.
Okay, we're changing the origin. And then the person thinks, so that character I now identified with means nothing. Because these people have changed it. It's not my Blunderman anymore.
Yeah, you know, feeling cheated that way in comics.
Yeah, it's a jumping off point. And you're trying to get a new audience, but you're sacrificing the audience you already have. No, That is
not
only an unkind thing to do, it's a stupid thing to do if you want to make money. So, in theory, if you are moving the realms along, you do not want to say no to the people who came on board at second edition, or mm-hmm. third edition, or fourth edition. You don't want to say, you know, you guys who bought all that fourth edition, none of it to me. No, you want it to be all-inclusive. You want to try and please everyone. As we know in life, the moment you try and please everyone, it is not going to happen. But I give people points for trying.
Yeah.
And I think this is what Wizards of the Coast is trying to do right now. They are trying to come up with a realms going forward that will please the maximum number of gamers. And, you know, over the years, I have been part of the realms through all the regimes, and I have done comics set in the realms from all the, from the DC comics to the independents. That TSR put out itself. I just recently did a series with IDW, which is the Forgotten Realms, as we move towards into the Sundering.
Okay.
But, you see, at that point, it changed throughout the... So I was trying to write a story set in the realms that didn't really mention the Sundering because we didn't know which way we were going to do. So it became a miniseries, and there is now going to be another Forgotten Realms comic, not written by me, that takes place in another part of the realms during the Sundering.
Okay.
It has always been a process of continuous change. It's going to go on changing, but I want the realms to survive and still be fun for everybody.
Yes. With the success of many comic book movies and creating a movie universe, is there any talks or whispers that we might get some movies based on the Forgotten Realms?
Well, here's the thing. There have been talks and whispers for the last 3 decades.
Okay.
And back in the TSR days, too. Yeah. Flint went out to the West Coast, to Hollywood, to start Flint Dilley. He started TSR West, and that was, you know, basically to do movie properties. We have 3D&D movies, you know.
Yeah.
There's definite talk of it, but you see, here's the thing. The classical Hollywood thing is, hey, we're all going to get together and make this movie, and it's going to have pirates, and it's going to have Angelina Jolie, and it's going to have Danny DeVito, and it's going to have, you know, and then what happens is you change directors 56 times, one of your majors drops out or dies, you know, and then is it ever going to happen, or is it going to happen under a different name later on? Is the concept or script going to be rewritten so much you don't recognize it? So, you know, there's a big difference between saying, yes, we're going to have D&D movies, a big rumor, and them actually appearing.
Okay,
because, you know,
enough.
Things take millions of dollars in Hollywood now. They take years.
Yeah.
So, well, as an outsider looking in, I can say it is logical, Hasbro being what it is, and the scuttlebutt that has been made public about Warner Brothers and so on, and lawsuits flying around, that obviously some people are interested in it. But, I mean, I'm waiting with the same excitement like any gamer to say, oh, coming soon to a theater in New York. No, I don't want that soon off it, and I want it coming May 15th or whatever date it's going to be to a theater in New York.
That's what I love, just meeting and talking to you right now, just how big of a fan you also are of your work, your realms, and just of gaming in general. And as you were talking about comics, too, like, what comics do you pick up right now?
Oh, boy. As the years have passed, I have gone more and more towards independence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picking up things like Cerebus, Strangers in Paradise. I would look at anything that Peter David did.
Okay.
So all of his series, you know, I would... anything Neil Gaiman did.
Oh, yeah.
I would pick up. All of the comic stores I used to shop at died, moved multiple times. The ones in Toronto kept... You see, I come from Toronto. Toronto is larger than Chicago.
Yes.
Okay, so... And it has the endemic problems of any large city. No parking downtown. And for a while there, I could get to the comic book stores, but they kept moving to locations that were worse and worse for driving. And I'd say, guys, and they'd say, well, take the TTC, which is our public transit. And I'd say, well, that's really nice, but they stop about 120 miles short of my front door. You know, so, and when I go to comic book stores, I want to shop. Because all of our comic book stores aren't just comic book stores. They sell science fiction and fantasy novels. They sell little toy robots. They sell a Witchblade statuettes and stuff like that. I want to bring the car. I want to fill it. You know, because I don't get out much. So I don't want to be told... You see, the where the Baca and the Silver Snail. We had a great science fiction bookstore, which still exists, by the way, in Toronto, and Silver Snail, a great comic store, which still exists, by the way, but they used to be across the road from each other. They're now in...
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah, and if you bought too much stuff, you went two blocks east to Gold's Luggage Shop, and you bought a really cheap suitcase, you brought it back to the store, filled it with your purchases, and then schlepped it home on the subway or to wherever your car was parked. You can't do any of that stuff anymore. Gold's Luggage is gone, and these two stores have moved. So I used to buy by the cartload, and my pick list was, you know, waiting for me, and it was huge. It's gotten smaller and smaller over the years because both companies, DC with Crisis, and then I mean, everybody's going, Crisis? But I mean, that's recent to me.
Yeah.
And then Marvel after that. Yeah. When you redo the origins of everybody, you give longtime fans the chance to step off the train as well as step on. So my actual monthly list has been going down and going down. And every time somebody does a startup, and there have been other comic companies that started up and lasted and so on, I would try some of their stuff, like Ruse, the comic book for CrossGen that was a sort of Sherlock Holmesian.
Okay.
You know, I would buy that for the Butch Goose art and so on. The various licenses of Conan, Dark Horse and so on, I would buy them, you know, and really enjoy them. And then we went into the era of miniseries. So
everything's like a mini series, and so it's almost like, okay, I don't need that one, I'll get that one, and now it's...
And I can distinctly recall that the first time my era of buying my own comics, paying for them myself by the cartload, the first comic was Hulk, I think it's 112, I'm not sure. He's fighting the leader, and it was called World's End, and comic books cost 12 cents. They'd just gone up from 10.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That 2 pennies back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Are there any bigger name, you know, superheroes that you are still reading, like Hulk, or have you pretty much gone straight to independent?
I read all the X books.
Okay.
I have a soft spot for the X-Men because the one time I got to do anything with Marvel, it was continuity and it was on the X-Men, and it was because I kept my X-Men collection. So they could phone me because they hadn't. And I just, my jaw dropped around my ankles. It's like, Marvel and nobody kept a copy of every issue?
Yeah.
What were you guys, nuts?
Yeah,
going back but, check continuity. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, there were other stories behind that. But yeah, it was so... When they went into the Beast's apartment, the Beast was all blue back then, you know, and he had various unattractive scholarly girlfriends. When they went into his apartment, his door opened either outwards or inwards and either right or left consistently from comic to comic. Same thing with Aunt Jane in Spider-Man.
Oh, Aunt May?
Aunt May, excuse me. Aunt May. Excuse me. I'm getting old. You know, Peter was always very protective of her, but he could never always be around for her because he was wearing a costume and swinging, and she couldn't know. Well, okay. What did her house look like? What did her apartment look like? What did the steps look like? That sort of stuff. That was the sort of thing you were checking.
Okay.
And yet you were a fan all the way through. But because of that, you felt that sort of you're an insider for the book all of a sudden, then you stay with all the X books and you see what they're doing. And we go through the era where comics looked like paintings and where there were like 42 different X books a month, you know?
Yeah.
And that's typical of anybody's journey through comics. Mm-hmm. There's years and years ago, hockey is really big in Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
Hockey?
Yeah.
Okay.
And years and years ago, Ken Dryden, who was a famous goalie for the Montreal Canadiens back in the day, was asked, when was the golden age of hockey? And he said, when you were 12. He didn't say a year. He said, when you were 12.
It doesn't matter when you're 12.
Yeah,
that's when you like it.
Now, he may be off by 1 or 2 years for an individual person, but he's right with the concept. There's this point in time when things are golden for you. And the things that were golden for me were actually before I could afford to buy comics. So all my friends had stacks and stacks of comics, mainly missing their covers. going back into the dawn of time. Timely Comics.
Okay.
With Stan Lee as a writer for Timely Comics and the Human Torch, you know, before Marvel was founded. And then the founding comics of Marvel and all the early stuff with Ditko doing Spider-Man and Kirby doing everything else. You know, and reading through all the way up through this. So I got to read all of this stuff. It was the comic book I mentioned was my chance to purchase for myself so I could build a monthly list. I could buy just what I wanted rather than my dad picking up an issue on the way home, which, let's face it, meant my dad was censoring.
Yeah.
You know, he would be stopping on his way home from work downtown. I'd have requested this. He'd pull it out. If he didn't like what was inside, no, they didn't have it. You know? So I got to watch Conan the Barbarian debut in comics. Barry Windsor Smith's beautiful art, you know, all that stuff. I got to watch Roy Thomas begin as a writer, become the writer of everything, become the head editor, resign from being the head editor, write just the books he wanted, and take Thor through Ragnarok, you know, and all that stuff.
The first Ragnarok.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly.
Well, one last question for you that we like to ask everyone is, do you have a zombie plan? And if so, do you want to share it?
A zombie plan?
Yeah, when they take over, do you have where you're going to do? Go to a bunker, go to a friend's house.
Oh, okay, I live on what is in effect a moribund farm right now. I have a barn. I have a cottage property with nothing on it anymore. I have a little hut in the woods. And I have a large book of zombie recipes. And you know that cycle of life, what goes around comes around? I figure if we're eating zombies and it's going out the other end and it just comes around again, goes around, and then I don't have to travel, I don't have to endanger myself getting, because, well, the food will be right there.
It'll just come to your door.
We'll just have
delivery.
To have interesting sauces to cover up the taste.
Yeah.
Well, Ed Greenwood, you really are the sage of Shadowdale. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for talking
with
us. It was fun. And we are Matt and Tony, and we've been talking to Ed Greenwood.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you.
They follow the captain one by one.